no, just it's always such a wonderful moment when people make that commitment. And I don't know what it is. I mean, being in ministry a lot of years, it never gets old when people make that commitment, when people do that. Every time they do that, it makes us reflect. It kind of fills us with joy. It's always just such a special moment. It just never gets old when people are committing their lives to Christ. And so it's just a great video just to share that with you. I love some of the expressions on people's faces when you see it. It's just totally a beautiful moment. We started off this year where I just wanted to say a few words about inspiring us towards a new year, maybe giving us a word of hope, a word that says, hey, everything's going to be okay in this coming year. Just hopefully saying something that inspires us or is positive. And I think we need a lot of positivity in our lives right now. Last week we started by asking the question sort of, how's your faith? How's our faith? And we talked about this idea of weak and strong faith. And it seems so interesting to me that we are the ones that are obsessed with how weak and how strong our faith is. God is not obsessed with that. That is our obsession. We talked about the focus of our faith should not be the strength of our faith. Sometimes we get polluted by that idea of saying our faith is supposed to be somewhere rather than just having faith. Also talked last week about what strong faith, in my opinion, really is. Strong faith is just weak faith wrapped in vulnerability. When we have some awareness that God is going to do most of the work regardless of how much we bring to the table, it helps us to become people of great faith. Not strong faith always, but great faith. Today we're going to kind of shift gears and talk about how do we measure faith. Yes, I know I've talked, it's not about if you're strong or if you're weak, but I think there should be some measurement tools that we use to say, how am I doing in my journey of faith? And so in order to talk about that, I'm going to kind of let you see behind the curtain of church a little bit. In church, we measure things by counting. That's what we do. We count things in church. Now, the reason why we count things at this church is maybe not the same reason why everybody counts things. What are the two things, if you had to just think about, what are the two things that churches like to count? We like to count money and people, okay? How much money are we getting every week and how many people are coming to church? That's how we count things. And the part of the reason why we count those things is because they're easy to count. They're definitive, and they give us direct answers. Now, when we count things, we do count both of those things, by the way, but we don't count those things to say, hey, how are we doing? We count those things to say, where is the greatest need in our church? Hey, we need to pour some more resources into this area because those are the people that are coming. Hey, we've realized that we're a little over-resourced right here. We need to pull back a bit and put that in other places where people are. You see, the reality is that I have a lot of pastor friends who they have defined their churches by how many people go to their churches or how fast they're growing. And it's not a bad thing because when people give their money and when people come to church, it means that they're invested. It's one of the signs that tells us, yes, we're doing the right thing. But counting money and attendance is like in a marriage counting, well, how many years we've been married and how often we have dinner together. Or how good a budget we have. Yes, those things should be healthy and should be good, but just because you've been married for 50 years doesn't mean you have a healthy marriage. And just because you've been married for 2 doesn't mean your marriage is unhealthy or not going anywhere. It's a good thing. People that are happy generally are married for a long period of time. Generally, they do eat meals together. Generally, they do make decisions together. But measuring in a marriage is about how connected we are. How's our communication? How are we coming together in moments of crisis and in moments of joy? The measurement is very different. And we have to learn to see with new eyes. We have to learn to look at things with new eyes. You know, when COVID happened, our churches emptied out. You guys were very gracious to watch us online, even though we had a bit of a rocky start there. And you guys gave very generously throughout the entirety of 2020. And we were very blessed by that. And that did tell us, hey, you're being affirmed. You're doing the right thing. But some of my pastor friends, they have defined their churches by how big their churches are getting or how quick their churches are growing. And if you take all that away, some of them had some identity crisis. When you go to conference as a pastor, you'll meet new people. And guess what? There's always one question that everybody asks every other pastor. I don't ever ask this question, but it's often asked. People will talk, oh, where do you pastor? Oh, I'm over here. How big's your church? Who cares? I would rather walk with 50 committed people than 500 who are just spectators. I would rather have people that actually want to be there, that are not coming for a performance, that are coming to be transformed and to be changed. How do we measure growth and encounters with God? That's a lot harder to measure, isn't it? How are you doing spiritually? Is what we're doing here making a difference in your life, in the lives of your children, and all the rest of it? As a person, I try to believe in three things in my life. I try to believe in leadership, transparency, and accountability. And that's why when you have a membership packet, you pick it up and we have some expectations and accountability. Not because we're trying to be the police, but because we say, if you want to grow spiritually and you want to open your life up to God, that's why it's a big deal for you to come and be in attendance often, to maybe join a group, to give of your first fruits to the Lord. These things are important, not because we want to police them, but because they help us know how we're doing in relation to God and our faith. We need to use this word a little bit more, the word practice. You know, practice has a variety of contexts in our world. The first one is, if you play any kind of sports or any kind of athletic behavior, you practice first. And we all know what practice is. We know that if you're going to practice, you're trying to work out all the obstacles, all the difficulties. We know that practice is not the game, but we want to get ready for the game. Practice has value. If you try to run the New York Marathon and you haven't jogged a day in your life, you're going to have a hard time, because we know that practice prepares us for the real thing. We also use words like practice medicine. We never say that doctors do medicine. They practice medicine. Well, people don't do law. They practice law. Now, sometimes I get it. You know, you go to the doctor and it feels like they're just practicing. They make you put the little robe on and it's open at the back and they're prodding and pushing you. And that happened to me last week, but I guess that's what they do at the dentist nowadays. I mean, I was there, so they want to check it out. And sometimes it feels like they're just guessing, you know. Let's try this. Let's do this. That's not what's happening. The reason why that is specifically used is because what it's saying is, this is not a definitive science. There's always more to learn. You will be a lifelong student. You will never get to a point where you go, I've got it all, and I figured it all out. And maybe the reminder in the midst of that is, we don't do our faith. We practice our faith. It doesn't mean that we don't try hard. It doesn't mean that we push ourselves. What it means is, we're getting ready for the game. We're getting ready for those big moments. About 20 years ago, I was in seminary, so I was 11 20 years ago, in case you're wondering. And I was about 23, 24. And what you learn when you do your studies is, if you're an undergrad, you read about 2 to 3 books per class, and when you get to grad school, you read between 12 and 15 books a class. You have 4 classes in the spring and 4 in the fall. And if you do the math, it's about 100 books a year. It's a lot. You're reading a book about every 3.5 days. And you get to a point where you just can't consume anymore. Your brain just goes to overload. And part of that is intentional, because they want to sort of disrupt what we've always thought. They want to kind of put out everything that's out there and test why we believe what we believe. And it's a healthy exercise, but it is very overwhelming. And you get to a point where you just can't even look at another book. You just got no more room in your brain to put whatever this author, as well-intentioned as they might be, you've just got no more space. And I remember I was going to do a summertime at a church, about a 12-week period, at a church in Chelsea, Michigan. I was living in Michigan at the time. And everybody knows where Chelsea, Michigan is. And I'm going to tell you why. Because if you've ever bought those boxes of Jiffy Mix, they only make them in one place in the world, and it's Chelsea, Michigan. So you know where it is. There's a small church, about 50 people at this church. It was a great little church, and I got to live in the little parsonage, which was right next to the church, little 3-bedroom house, which was a far cry from my dorm room that I've lived in for a long time. So it was a great summer. And I got up that first Sunday with these people, and I talked about this idea of practicing our faith. And when I ended the sermon, when I was talking through the sermon, I was talking about, you know, in the early church, people couldn't read and all that kind of stuff, and they really just were much more involved in the practice of faith. They didn't have Bibles the way that we do. And I ended it with this exact line. I said, we all know more Bible than we practice. What I want us to do is I want us to spend time practicing what we know and not just be obsessed with reading. Because my brain was kind of on overload. There's a lady at this church. We'll call her Sue. And that may or may not be her real name. She was not a very nice person. She was cruel and mean. I never heard a kind word come out of her mouth. She was gossipy and condescending. And she made sure, if ever I preached, that she would let me know what I did wrong and what I could do better the next week. She made a beeline for me after that sermon. And she looked me in the face and she got right up in my grill and she said, I cannot believe that you said that. I cannot believe that somebody who wants to be a preacher has condoned the practice of not reading their Bible. And just went on to chastise me. And I was just trying to say, hey, listen, I'm just try to understand what I'm saying. And she said, I get up every single morning and I read my Bible for 30 minutes. And I said, you know, it'd be awesome if your life reflected it. Didn't say that. But I thought it. But as I thought about it a little bit more, I realized I couldn't say that. Because just because my struggles in faith are different than hers, doesn't mean that I'm somehow different. I felt sad because the connection between her head and her heart had not been made. She was living her faith here, not here, not here. I've learned that we measure our faith through practice. What Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, when you get to chapter 7, he kind of deals with this issue, and he says in verse 21, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. What he's saying is, just because you say you're a Christian and that you believe in God doesn't mean you are. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, did we not prophesy or preach in your name? Did we not drive out demons in your name and perform many miracles? Then I will tell them plainly, I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice, like a wise person builds a house. Micah says it very well, too. A little different. Micah chapter 6, beginning in verse 6, says this. With what shall I come before the Lord and bow down before the exalted God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000 rivers of olive oil? Shall I offer my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has shown you, O mortal, what is good. And what does God require of you? To act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. Reading your Bible is easy to count. Doing these things, not so much. When we look at the world and we look at injustice and we say, God is calling me there. Or in a world that is unkind and sore, we need to step towards mercy and kindness. And then we have to have a good view of ourselves as we walk before God. Powerful words that Micah says, and even more difficult to live out. I'm going to be that dad for a minute that plays a little video of his kids just for a second, but it's valuable. This is a video taken about 5 years ago. Emery was about 3 years old at the time. And I'm going to tell you why this video inspires me. Let's watch this together. So what's in your heart, Emery?
Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, Exodus and faithful and faithfulness and self control.
Good
job. Wow.
I want to see the video.
Your kids do the same thing, don't they? Let me tell you why that inspires me. Paul says this, Galatians 5, beginning in verse 22. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Against such things, there's no law. What he means is, there's no limit to how much you can grow in these things. Those who belong to Christ have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires, and since we live by the Spirit, let us keep in step with the Spirit. The reason why that little video inspires me is because if we can teach that to a 3-year-old, we can teach it to a 33-year-old, we can teach it to an 83-year-old, and it can become the anthem of what our faith is striving to be. That we begin to learn to practice our faith towards completion, not perfection. I think we are obsessed with how good and how shiny our faith is. But what Paul is writing here, and notice it says fruit of the Spirit, not fruits of the Spirit, okay? He's not showing us a fruit bowl and saying, you know, here are the grapes of joy and here whatever else. He's saying what shows in your life when you are trying to live your life towards God are these things. And every one of us, these 9 qualities, and let me tell you, this is not a conclusive list. This is the starting point. I think Paul is being graceful and saying, hey, if you can, why don't you start with these 9 instead of the other, you know, 91? Just start with these 9 and see how you do with those. And there's times in our lives where we grow in one area and we struggle with the other. Patience, probably for most of us, especially if you have children, that's always going to be a tough one, right? We're always going to struggle with these things. Kindness, when people are just crude and crass and unkind. Being gentle. These are hard things for us to do. And Paul is saying, but when the Spirit of God is alive in us, our lives look different. And that's what I want to inspire us with today. God is not obsessed about how strong or weak your faith is, or putting down these 9 things and saying, now check the ones that you're doing well and draw an unhappy face next to the other ones and go home and feel bad. I think sometimes what we've done is we've made faith an intellectual exercise. And Jesus, in his first sermon, he says it's not about knowing. It's about doing our best to put our faith into practice. Knowing that we're going to do that imperfectly. But I find sometimes, even in my own faith, that I have put myself in a prison cell and I've shackled myself to the wall. And these words are about Christ opening that door, walking over to me, and unlocking the chains that I put on myself and throwing them to the ground and saying, I'm going to wake up with you tomorrow and we're going to give this a try. By the time you go to bed, you're going to have so much critique of how you could have done everything better, but that's okay. While you sleep, I'm going to wash the slate clean. And when you rise tomorrow, we're going to do it all over again. The journey of faith is what matters. Not how strong your faith is or how weak your faith is or if you're getting enough check marks on that invisible list that we make for ourselves. Try and fail, that's okay. If you have days where you find success, that's great. But all of it can be summed up in just one word. Faith. Do we have the courage to just have faith? Father, today, thank you for giving us moments of worship, moments of word, that we can move closer to you. Father, may we have the courage to believe the words that we sing. May we have the courage however imperfectly we do it, to just try and be people of faith. Father, thank you for not requiring perfection from us. Thank you that you send your Son, who was perfect, so that that burden has been taken off our shoulders. May we accept our imperfections. May we accept the areas that we need to grow in. God, would you take us by the hand and lead us to those places? We long to be better in our faith. But God, we thank you so much that the strength or the perfection of our faith is not where you're looking. Please take our hearts today. Please take our lives as we bring our lives to the altar. Would you speak to us mightily and powerfully? We pray this all through Jesus.